Welcome back into day three of WTUZ news presentation of the life of Private Emmett Schwartz and his return home. Nick McWilliams and Mary Alice joining you from the WTUZ studios. And Mary, of course, yesterday you had that conversation with Mr. Sean Everett and talked a little bit about what the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency is all about. But today our topic is a little more in-depth about the real intense process it is to ultimately identify a soldier quite very similar to Private Emmett Schwartz.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone who listened yesterday would have heard a lot about just kind of the overall aspect of what that headquarters out in Washington, D.C. does, and how that they basically are the home base, if you will, for the historians and the anthropologists who go out and do all the research.
Well, speaking of anthropologists, that's actually who I had a talk with, Dr. Tracy Von Diest. She's a forensic anthropologist with the DPAA. Had a lot of great information about how this process works, how everything goes through. We didn't talk necessarily specifically about Private Schwartz, but you know, she mentioned all the different scenarios and how this kind of potentially works. You know, something I definitely wanted to mention, we've kind of alluded to it this week, but Private Schwartz is one of thousands of soldiers who have now been identified and ultimately brought back home thanks to the DPAA, but thousands more that it still remain unaccounted for, which is what this agency does every day to try to bring those soldiers home.
Absolutely. Over 81,000 Americans still accounted for, and of course, half of those we will never be able to recover because of, you know, out in the ocean or some circumstance like that. But as you mentioned, you know, we're doing this all for Private Schwartz. He was 24 when he enlisted. He was married, had a son at the time, and he gave his ultimate sacrifice for this. And so it's just a great kind of opportunity to take time to learn about how he was eventually recovered and is returning home later this week.
Definitely. Well, I won't go into too much detail about the discussion the doctor and I had. Of course, we'll be hearing that momentarily, but kind of talked about it a little bit yesterday, and I'll talk about it a little more here. It all starts with the historical side of this. Historians, it's something that the doctor did mention that, you know, this all goes back to the military records of where this person would have ultimately last been seen, of course, with Private Schwartz last place being seen in the Hurtung Forest. That was where they kind of started their journey, so to speak, to find him. Of course, he had already been interned elsewhere. I believe it was in 1950, if I'm not wrong on that.
So, yes.
Right. And so kind of you can't say easier because obviously the work that they are doing here is very important and very in-depth. But for him, that's kind of where the process got rolling. And then a lot of what we talked about kind of related to how things go from there. But just amazing to see all the different working parts.
Yeah, absolutely. As my conversation, part of it with Sergeant Everett from yesterday, we had mentioned, and you can find that on the DPAA's website, the names of all those who are still missing. So it essentially starts right there, that name, and going into, you know, where they were stationed, as you had mentioned.
Perfect. Well, thank you for that, Mary. And we'll now go to our conversation with Dr. Tracy Von Diest, the forensic anthropologist with the DPAA.
Realistically, for you guys going into this process, how does the ball kind of start rolling? We know there's a lot of soldiers that throughout the years have been unaccounted for. So really, how do things start in order to trying to track down some of these people's identities?
Here at the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, any missing service member, first we start with all the historical information. We have a large team of historians and researchers who look through the historical records to determine where a specific service member was potentially last seen. They do that through military records, looking at troop movements through specific areas, and can then see where potentially these individuals would have been lost and are most likely located.
And whenever you guys go through those records and kind of pinpoint at least an area or potential area where these the missing could possibly be, what's kind of the next step? Is it more of the narrowing down, so to speak?
Yes. So the next step from there is going to be to determine whether or not there are any individuals or any unknown sets of remains that were recovered either during or shortly after the conflict. And so there are lots of sets of remains that have been buried all over the world that were recovered and at the time could not be identified. In other instances, if it's something like an aircraft crash or a specific loss incident where the remains were potentially not recovered and are still located in a specific area, that's when we send out investigation teams to do more research, both on the ground and through historical records in the area, to see if we can pinpoint where those remains may still be. When it comes to unknowns that may have been recovered, in the post-war accounting period, those would have been examined, potentially identified, and then buried in temporary cemeteries. And so the historians are also looking at the records for unknown sets of remains and then comparing them and making a short list of individuals who are lost in a specific area around where those remains would have been originally recovered. And a team of historians, anthropologists, and dentists will examine all the historical records about both the individuals lost in the area as well as the unknown set of remains to see if we can come up with a short list of who that unknown set of remains likely is.
Gotcha. And with those kind of factors in mind here, so obviously I'm going to guess that this process, I mean, the general idea of trying to find a way to identify who this is kind of the same, but I'm sure in a case-by-case basis, this is could be very different.
It can be, but it all generally relies around the same lines of evidence. So we've already touched on the historical evidence as well as whether the remains are going to be coming in as an unknown set of remains out of a cemetery or as a disinterment or from an archaeological or field recovery is another way that remains and evidence come into the laboratory. And once those remains are in the laboratory, they're looked at by an anthropologist. We assess the remains for the elements that are present. Those remains are then sampled for DNA analysis, and those samples are sent to the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System DNA Identification Laboratory at Dover Air Force Base, where they do all the processing of the samples from the remains that we send in. And they also house the family reference samples, so the families of the missing that have submitted DNA samples for comparison, and they do the comparisons there and provide us with that information. We also have odontologists or forensic dentists on staff who compare any dental remains that come into the laboratory to the dental records that are available for the missing service members that are thought to be candidates for a given set of remains.
Definitely a long list of different possibilities of ways to ultimately determine who each one of these missing soldiers is. I do have to ask, too, I'm sure there are some challenges that might go into this, especially considering that these might be some very old remains that are potentially found.
There are challenges just with time. The condition of the remains when they come in can be a challenge. Sometimes it can be difficult based on how the remains were treated in the past for disinterments through previous mortuary practices, as well as sometimes the environment if they're coming in from an archaeological recovery. It can be difficult to actually get DNA from remains for comparison, and that's why we try to use multiple types of DNA. So there's the mitochondrial DNA, which traces the maternal line of a family, so that flow through the women, so mother to children. And then there is a Y DNA, which traces from a father to sons through a family, and then autosomal DNA, which is the DNA that's kind of unique to each person. You get half from your biological mother and half from biological father. Portions of your individual DNA will be shared with your siblings, with your parents, and your offspring. And so AFDIL, or the DNA laboratory at the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System, can do a lot of comparisons for different types. And so we can use lots of different family members to help narrow down that comparison for DNA. Also, sometimes, even though there are lots of records available, there are sometimes challenges with gaps in that historical record.
And after somebody has been positively identified from your office, what's kind of the next step from there? I'm assuming it is then trying to find maybe surviving family or things along those lines to hopefully give, I guess you could say, some form of closure and also let these people know that their family member has ultimately been found.
That is taken care of by the Service Casualty Office of each branch of the military. So when identification is made through the BPAA. We then notify the service casualty office, and then they reach out to the next of kin that they have on record for the notifications.
A thank you to Dr. Von Diest and everyone with the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency for their conversations they've had with us so far. And, you know, Mary, kind of in closing from this segment, I think what a lot of people from this area should take into consideration here. You've mentioned the sacrifices that Private Schwartz obviously made, 24 years old, married, fighting for his country.
Yeah.
I think that this is a great lesson, too, to show how important and how much we should be thankful for that with all the efforts that this agency is going through in order to make sure that he was ultimately identified and brought home. You know, that's reserved for the true American heroes. And of course, Private Schwartz falls into that category.
Absolutely. And of course, details are still kind of vague at the moment of when he will be returning home this weekend. But of course, there's going to be a private ceremony for surviving family who we will be hearing tomorrow, actually. And but they are also asking folks to come out to the Tuscarawas County Courthouse and again, pay that respect as a community, as we should do. Since he was a New Philadelphia graduate, he lived here, and you know, we're his community, basically.
Yes, and you know, you can't, overstate how important the men and women who have made this kind of sacrifice are to the United States as a whole. So, please, if you have an opportunity, if you have the time, go out and pay your respects to Private Schwartz. We will get those details out there as soon as possible once they are hammered out and set in stone, so to speak. So, once again, thank you for tuning in to this special presentation throughout this week from the WTUZ News Team. Mary Alice, Nick McWilliams here, talking about the life and sacrifice of Private Emmett Schwartz as we welcome him back home.